is fire and flaming road, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I, bowed neath heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Our next guest on Downtown is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, founding member, frontman of the Byrds, has released 10 solo albums through the years, and has collaborated with the likes of Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, and his old friend Chris Hillman. He'll be appearing here in Maine at the Waldo Theater on September 13th. We are happy to welcome to the program Roger McGuinn. I want to go back to the beginning. It was Elvis and Heartbreak Hotel that lit that fire, right?
That's right. I was given a transistor radio when I was 13. I used to ride my bicycle around Chicago listening to WJJD, which at the time was a rock station, and I heard Heartbreak Hotel come over the air, and I went, wow, this is great. It was such a different kind of music. You know, I really hadn't been exposed to blues or too much country music at that point. And the rock and roll I'd heard was like Bill Haley and the Comets. And, you know, so Elvis came over and it was just really captivating and different.
So how old were you when you started playing in clubs in Chicago?
Well, I got a guitar for my 14th birthday. I spent a couple of years learning how to play guitar and banjo at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. And after a couple of years, I got good enough to get a job at a coffee house. So I was about maybe 16 when I started playing. I guess it would be semi-professionally. I was getting $10 a night, which translated in today's money is $100. So I was living at home, and I saved my money, and I bought a nice Martin guitar and a Vega long-neck five-string banjo like Pete Seeger had, and I was ready to go.
That's fantastic. And was it there where the Limelighters first saw you?
Yeah. After the coffee house gig, I walked down to the Gate of Horn, which was was on Dearborn and Chicago Avenue in the basement of the Rice Hotel. And they had folk music. They had a listening room and a bar. They're separated so you could, you know, people at the bar wouldn't interrupt the performances. And I walked into the bar, and there was a jam session going on with the Limelighters and Theodore Bikel. And they saw me come in with my banjo and guitar from the coffee house gig, and Alex Hasselhoff, one of the Limelighters, said, "Hey, what do you got there, kid?" And I said, "I got a banjo and a guitar." He said, "Oh, great, break out the banjo. We got too many guitars going." So I played with them till 5 o'clock in the morning, and that's when they invited me to work with them.
And how did you end up getting together with Bobby Darin?
Well, it was a succession of people I played with. After the Limelighters, I played with the Chad Mitchell Trio, and I was playing with the Chad Mitchell Trio in California at the Crescendo Club on Sunset, and Bobby Darin was out in the audience. He was there to see Lenny Bruce as we were opening up for Lenny. And he came backstage after the Chad Mitchell set and said, "Hey, I like what you're doing up there. I'm thinking about putting a folk music segment in my show, and I'd like to hire you." And I said, "Well, I've already got a job with the Chad Mitchell Trio." And he said, "Yeah, what are they paying you?" And I told him, he said, "I'll double it." And I was ready to move on at that point anyway, so I said, "Okay."
Now, when did you first pick up that Rickenbacker?
I didn't pick up a Rickenbacker until 1964. I was already into the Beatles. I'd heard them on the radio. I bought their record, Meet the Beatles, I think it was, and I'd learned all the songs. And I loved the Beatles. And so David Crosby and Gene Clarke and I think Chris Hillman, went to the Pix Theater in Hollywood to see A Hard Day's Night. And that's the first time I saw a Rickenbacker 12-string. George Harrison had one. He'd been given by Rickenbacker. And I thought that was a wonderful-sounding guitar, and it looked great, too. It was really a cool-looking guitar. So I went out, and I traded a 12-string Gibson acoustic guitar and my 5-string long-neck banjo and got a Rickenbacker. And it was a great sound. It was just the best sound.
Yeah, this is Bruce. You got a particularly good sound out of that. Jack Elliott and I were driving in Rhode Island one time on the way to a gig, and Tambourine Man came on, the Byrds version, and he said to me, "In two notes, I can tell you that's McGuinn." And it seemed to me that forever that's been true. I've always been wondered how you came up with the intro to Tambourine Man. Now, my friend Alan Sanders swears it's because you were playing etudes on the guitar. I don't know if she's telling me the truth or not, but that sounds pretty interesting.
Well, Pete Seeger had done Jesus Joy of Men Desiring on his, I think it was called Goofing Off Suite.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned it on the banjo, and then I translated it to the guitar. And so I had that in my head. But also, if you listen to the da-dee-da-dee-da-doo-doo-doo, that melody appears in the song Mr. Tambourine Man as well, in the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
Your friend Chris Hillman was on with us a couple of years ago, and he told a great story. He was in another band, but he went to a session, and it was you and David and Gene working, and he was impressed with what he heard. And Jim Dixon asked him, do you play the bass? And even though he didn't, like any good musician, he said, absolutely.
Yeah, well, if you fake it till you make it, right?
Right, right.
Right, well, we needed a bass player because originally David Crosby was supposed to be the bass player, but for some reason he couldn't sing and play the bass at the same time. And so he got the Gretsch guitar that Gene Clark was going to play, and I kept playing my Rickenbacker, and we got Chris to learn how to play the bass. But Chris was already a guitar player, and the bass is just a guitar with lower strings.
Now, was it Mr. Tambourine Man that the record company said, no, this can't be a single?
No, that wasn't the case. We got the demo of it from Whitmark and Sons, the publishing company in New York that Dylan had. And Dylan, they're shopping his songs for other people to cover. And so we got this demo of it. It was like 4.5 minutes long in 2/4 time. And Dylan and Ramblin' Jack were singing it. And it didn't quite sound good. And Crosby said, I don't like it. So it was within the Byrds that the song was controversial. Once we worked it up and had an arrangement, Columbia Records had no problem with it.
You said something, I don't remember whether this was on an album cover liner notes somewhere, about making the change in the sound from the days of Sinatra, I think you referred to it, it's almost like a roar or something, and to a new sound. And I think of the harmonies of the Byrds being that new sound and so much of it. How much of that was from listening to the Limelighters and the Chad Mitchell Trio, and how much of it was Crosby, and how much of it was just trying to find a new harmonic range for rock music?
Well, the analogy was that the transportation devices of the time influenced music. And so I compared Sinatra to like a prop plane, like maybe a super constellation, you know, kind of a mm-hmm. roar. And then when jets came out, they sort of wound up and they did different Doppler dynamics than prop planes did. So that was the thinking for that. Folk music at that point was kind of reaching a peak. It had kind of peaked out in 1965. And all the new folk singers were writing their own stuff, you know, like Joni Mitchell and so on. And so I think it's just a matter of listening to different things and the timing of it. I wanted to get a sound like the Beatles, but we used folk music as a reference. And so it was just a combination of the two.
And you guys get labeled as folk or folk rock, and yet there were so many different sounds that the Byrds created. What led you to create, I think, an opus for you guys in 8 Miles High?
Okay, well, as you said, we got labeled as folk rock, and we didn't really want to get typecast in any particular box. So we experimented with different music, and David Crosby was really into jazz, and he introduced me to John Coltrane. And I loved John Coltrane. I thought, this is really amazing. In fact, the first time I heard Coltrane, I felt like a red-hot poker was searing through my chest. You know, it was just an amazing, overwhelming experience. So I wanted to learn how to play my Rickenbacker guitar like Coltrane played his saxophone. And I played scales for hours a day just to get my chops up to do that. And so we recorded 8 Miles High in a Coltrane fashion. You can hear a lot of opening and closing valves kind of thing like he did on the sax. And people labeled it psychedelic.
We're talking with Roger McGuinn here on Downtown. Sweethearts of the Rodeo was such a landmark album, in many ways the genesis of country rock. But am I right that you wanted to incorporate even more styles, jazz and blues elements as well into that album?
Yeah, I wanted to do a chronological, maybe a two-record set, starting with early music, maybe Gregorian chant and the Baroque period, and move it up into how that became popular music and how the Celtic music came over to the Appalachians and turned into country music. And I wanted to do a whole chronological string of things, and then rockabilly and rock and roll, and get into jazz, and kind of finish it off with space music on a synthesizer. Well, it was a little too ambitious for everybody else, so they didn't really go along with me. And that, at that point, we met Graham Parsons, and he was really into country music, and he was so infectious about it that he got us to go to Nashville and record the Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
From your perspective, what's the artistic high point of the Byrds, either an album or even a single?
That's hard to say. I think maybe Notorious Byrd Brothers was probably peak. We kind of peaked there. Just to mention, you know, 8 Miles High. And the very first thing was you know, the whole rock and roll and folk music combined, Mr. Tambourine Man, Turn, Turn, Turn.
You had such a great relationship with Dylan through the years. Can you share the story about the creation of the Ballad of Easy Rider?
The Ballad of Easy Rider came about when Peter Fonda put some of his rock and roll songs on the soundtrack of the movie, just kind of as place cards, you know, place keepers. And then they grew to like it after they played it a few times. But he wanted one song that was the theme song or custom made for the movie. So he flew to New York and screened the movie for Bob, and Bob didn't like it. He didn't like the ending. And so he wrote down some notes on a paper napkin and said, "Here, give this to McGuinn. He'll know what to do with it." And Peter came over to my house with this napkin, and it was like the Holy Grail. He said, "Bob wants you to have this, man." And so I got it out. Didn't have a melody. It just had one verse and a chorus. And I wrote the second verse and came up with a tune for it. And that was it.
Do you still open your solo shows with My Back Pages?
Yeah, I do. It's become kind of a theme song for me, like Thanks for the Memories or I Did It My Way.
I read somewhere, though, that you said the Byrds, and you're proud of the work that you did there, but they were in some ways a diversion from you becoming a true folk singer.
Well, I always wanted to do like what Pete Seeger did, and I do it now. I do a one-man show. And it's kind of like the life of Will Rogers, except it's about me instead. And I just a chronological thing. I start out where I got my first job and how the songs came together and the different people I met. And it's people enjoy the stories.
You know, I arrived in the village between the end of the Great Folk Scare and the start of the Folk Revival, whatever they call it, the second time around. I was playing a lot of the same small clubs other people were playing. Then went and played in bands and stuff, but I found later in life that I really preferred playing solo. That it was not that it was back just to my roots, but that I controlled the show. Is that something you like about being a solo performer? I mean, it's you and the audience, and that's really it.
Yeah, it is. And Ramblin' Jack had a hand in that. I was on the Rolling Thunder Review with him, and he said, "You know, Roger, the best time I ever had was when Polly and me went on the road with a Land Rover and threw the guitar in the back and played all these little clubs and things." And I said, "That sounds really good," because at that point I had buses and trucks and equipment to ship and, you know, overhead and flying people around, and it was a hassle. And as you say, when you're up there by yourself, it's all you and you get all the fun.
Yeah, Jack and I toured together for 15 years, and one or two tours a year, mostly in the Northeast, Midwest. And I always found that the best shows were the places were sort of a little bit out of the way. The crowd was full. They were excited, and you could just control the pace of things. I mean, I had my 40 minutes. I knew what I was supposed to do. But one of the things that I've had heard so many people say about your solo show is that they always feel like it was just written yesterday, that it seems very fresh to people that have seen it. How do you keep that happening?
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, it's scripted. It's a one-man play, and it's got different modules for different songs. I've got all these different stories that I can weave in and out depending on the audience and, you know, reaction and so on. But I love doing it, and I'm basically an actor at this point, doing songs.
Your Folk Den project has been such a remarkable effort. How did all that start?
back in 1995, I was listening to a Smithsonian Folkways album of traditional songs, and it dawned on me that by that point, all the folk singers were singer-songwriters. And if you look at NPR's top 100 folk songs, only 8 of them are traditional. And I was concerned about the traditional part of folk music getting lost in the shuffle because of the music business favoring singer-songwriters, basically for financial reasons. And I thought, what's going to happen when Pete Seeger or Odetta dies, and they have now, and, you know, not many people doing traditional songs anymore. I thought, gee, I could do something about that. Well, I've always been into technology, and I had computers early on. I knew how to record on a computer. I knew how to put stuff on the Internet, which had just opened up in the early part of the 90s and so on. And so I thought, well, maybe I could have a web page and put folk songs up for free download and have the lyrics and the chords and a little story about the song, and people could learn the songs from that, and it would just keep them alive. And that was the whole thing. And over the years, I started in 95. I've been doing it for, 20-some years now.
Well, and it's wonderful to see those songs kept alive, and the production is so good. You create such great harmonies that it feels like you're listening to a band.
Well, yeah, I use Pro Tools, and I overlay tracks and so on. Yeah, so I get a band sound.
One of the things that I learned from Dave Van Rock years ago is that it's the way to keep old songs alive is just to keep playing them. And he would talk about Sport and Life, you know, which I think Brownie McGee wrote when he was 15 years old, and talk about how if we don't keep these songs and the traditional songs alive, the new songs we write are only going to be based on somebody else's new songs. And so I really admire you for staying with that.
Well, I just love the music. You know, it's like the... it's like in architecture, the old Victorians were viewed beautiful, and people tore them down and put up stainless steel building, you know, steel and glass buildings, and they're not quite as attractive.
What's it been like for you getting back out on the road here, mostly post-COVID?
It's great. It's really great to get back out there, and the audiences, my audience was... Back in the maybe 20 or so years ago, they were still working 9 to 5, and they couldn't show up except maybe on a Friday or Saturday night. Now the kids have gone to college, and they're out, and they can come out any time, and they do, and it's really fulfilling.
Can you talk a little bit about David Crosby? Obviously an immensely talented but a very complicated man, but you produce such wonderful work together.
Yeah, what about him?
What do you remember best about him, and what should people know about him that maybe they missed?
Well, he was a wonderful harmony singer. He was an excellent songwriter, and he and I were friends for a long time. We just kind of got into that thing where groups, competition for getting his songs on a record and so on. That's what soured the relationship. So, you know, I really liked him. I still have good memories of hanging out with him in L.A. in the early days. And it was we had a lot of fun together for a long time.
What do you see as the state of music today? Record companies don't have the power that they once had, and anybody can get their song out there. But there's also a lot more competition with a pretty chock-full internet. Would it be tougher to get started as a young performer and artist today?
Well, I think about Justin Bieber being discovered on YouTube, or Billy, at least, if you pronounce it that way, I don't know, on TikTok, and, you know, people are getting discovered. If you really have something good, people find it and notice it.
Now, the partnership that you've been a part of that's really stood the test of time is you and Camilla, nearly 50 years together. Congratulations on that. And what kind of a difference has she made, not just in your life, but with your music?
Well, she and I write songs together. We have since we got together back in the 70s. And she's just really wonderful. She does business. She does most of the business. And it's like having a manager and a business manager and a songwriter. And, you know, she wears all these different hats. So I really am happy that we got put together.
No, I read on her blog on the website that back during COVID, you were pretty much locked down and staying right there. Was there a time when you thought, well, that's it. I'm done going out on the road to play music?
We did think about it because we loved being home. We had a good time at home. And so I didn't really go out for a year or so. It was okay. But then we got back on the road and we said, oh, yeah, we got to keep doing this. This is great.
Well, we can't wait to see you September 13th, Wednesday night at the Waldo Theater in Waldoboro. It's going to be a great show. And it's been so wonderful for us to have a chance to talk with you today. Thank you for making some time for us.
You're welcome, Al. I'm looking forward to the show.
It's a great honor to talk to you again.
Waldo Theater in Waldoboro. It's going to be a great show. And it's been so wonderful for us to have a chance to talk with you today. Thank you for making some time for us.
You're welcome, Al. I'm looking forward to the show.
It's a great honor to talk to you again.
That was something, huh? Roger McGuinn. Bruce Pratt joined us for that. We recorded it earlier today. And again, Roger going to be at the Waldo Theater in Waldoboro on Wednesday, September 13th.